we did just a kind of a lightning review of renormalization. And again, so just saying, what happens is you go and you compute with your quantum field theory. You have these loop summations in which you, in a sense, sum over all intermediate possibilities. And the default assumption is that all intermediate possibilities includes momenta going up to infinitely large values. And you find that when you take momenta up to infinitely large values, it looks like things diverge. So you have to go back and think of it. And the way forward is to weaken that assumption. So instead of assuming that your theory is valid up to arbitrarily high energies, let's just assume that the theory is valid up to some large energy, but not necessarily arbitrarily high, and that something new happens at some large energy scale. And even though we don't know what happens at that large energy scale, we can take the main effects of that heavy physics at some high energy scale and reprocess it and, in a sense, subsume it only into some low energy variables in our effective theory. And the way to handle the Whippy divergences is to take your original Lagrangian, rewrite it in terms of so-called renormalized parameters and counter terms. And at this point, unless we have this special high energy theory that will make everything finite, in general, we don't know what it is. So what we have to do is simply choose these counter terms to make the result finite, and then to use data to fix the values of the renormalized terms here. So by using data, we simultaneously fix the values of these and these. So this just happens to be a choice that's up to us, but some choices are easier to work with than others. And these counter terms, in a sense, come in and handle all the divergences. And what we found in this theory, just looking at least at the one loop corrections to the one particle irreducible connected endpoint functions, there were essentially three different kinds of possible divergences. There's a possible divergence. There are two kinds of divergences possible in the two-point function. We saw that it could have a quadratic divergence. So lambda, if you recall, is the scale where I cut off the large loop momentum in Euclidean space. And it can also have a log divergence that goes like this. Or it can also have a log divergence proportional to p squared that corresponds, in a sense, to this operator, this p squared piece. And this p squared is handled by this counter term. And these pieces are handled by this counter term, roughly speaking. The other kind of divergence we could have, delta lambda 4, was a correction to the vertex. And this vertex correction is just a log divergence. And it could essentially be handled by this four-point thing. So I've only talked about one loop. And at least at one loop, I can use my three counter terms. These are all the one loop divergences I have. And I can use these counter terms to cancel off these divergences and make everything finite. So this is nice. But I guess an obvious question that came up is what about a higher loop order? And I'm not going to show that the same counter terms work at higher loop order, but it turns out they do. It turns out that by appropriately choosing these three counter terms, I can get rid of all the infinities to an arbitrarily high loop order. But a hand wavy argument for why this works is based on dimensional analysis. And the point of dimensional analysis is that for these endpoint functions, where I'm getting rid of the external propagators, the two-point function has mass dimension 2. The four-point function is dimensionless. If I looked at the six-point function, it would have mass dimension minus 2. And as I go higher and higher in endpoint functions, they become more and more negative in the mass dimension. So that's the first piece. The second piece is that the parameters in my theory, the dimensionful parameters in my theory, are essentially the momentum. I call it p squared, this mass m squared, and a possible cutoff lambda squared. And the general argument is that we expect the theory to, in a sense, have a smooth limit as I take either m squared to 0 or p squared to 0, or also lambda to 0. So from that point of view, M squared and P squared should typically appear in numerators. If you start getting them in denominators, you get a divergence as you took them to zero, and that's no good. So the upshot of this is that as I go to higher and higher loop order, in some sense, I'm running out of dimensional room for divergences. So here, if I only have positive powers of m squared or p squared, I can have a lambda squared. But for example, I couldn't have a lambda to the fourth over m squared, because that would diverge as m squared goes to zero. So the worst divergence I can have in this sense is a quadratic divergence. And similarly, in the four-point function, the worst I can have is log. But then as I go to higher endpoint functions, I run out of room for positive powers of the cutoff. So I realize this is very hand-wavy. But that's roughly the heart of the argument for why this set of counterterms works to renormalize the theory at any loop order. You essentially run out of room for positive powers of the cutoff. In principle, you can have negative powers of the cutoff, but that's not a problem because that's finite as the cutoff goes to infinity. Okay, so that's the story for this theory. And this theory is renormalizable in the sense that I only need these three counterterms. And corresponding to that, I only need three renormalization conditions. And I only need, it turns out, two physical inputs. I need some, for example, some measured value of the cross section, and that helps me fix the del lambda, and some measurement of the mass, and that helps me fix del m squared, and this del z just corresponds to a convention we choose for the normalization of the field. So that's nice. I take three physical inputs, and now I can go off and compute all kinds of other, I can make all kinds of other predictions, and that means that even though I need some physical inputs, my theory is predictive. I can make a much larger set of predictions than the set of inputs I need. This is great. I still need these inputs, but I still have a predictive theory. Suppose I now take the same theory, and suppose I now deform it by adding another term. And this term I'm going to add is going to have the following form. It's just going to be a phi to the sixth. So in four dimensions, phi has mass dimension 1. So this combination, so this is obviously mass dimension 6. The Lagrangian is mass dimension 4 in four dimensions. So that means that I need two powers of some dimensionful scale in a denominator to make everything up. And then this zeta 0 is dimensionless. And if I was to go through the same process as before, I'd expect that I could also rewrite this in terms of some renormalized parameter. And I'd also have to add a counterterm for it. So I'll write the counterterm in this way. But it turns out that if I just do this, this isn't the whole story. And this modified theory, with this one extra operator, turns out not to be renormalizing. So first of all, suppose we look at the six-point function in this case. We had a previous contribution to the six-point function at one loop. And the previous contribution to the six-point function at one loop had that form. So this is without the new operator. And this piece, if you recall, goes like lambda cubed integral d4q over 2 pi to the fourth. I'll just Euclideanize stuff as I go along. Qe squared plus m squared cubed. And it's cubed because I have three propagators. But now on top of this, with this new operator, I have a new contribution where I use the new six-point vertex. So a six-point vertex has six legs coming out of it. And I can attach that to a four-point vertex. And I can get another contribution to the six-point, the 1pi connected six-point function. And if you look at this new piece, I have one power of the new vertex. I have one quartic vertex that I had before. And now I have two propagators. So this new thing is going to go like lambda theta over m squared integral d4qe over 2 pi to the fourth, 1 over qe squared plus m squared squared. And then I have my counterterm. So I have my 6-point counter term, which is going to be something like something like that. So this piece is finite. So I don't even need a counter term for that. And that's what we found before. This piece, though, has a log divergence. This piece goes like lambda zeta over m squared. I have 4 powers in the numerator, 4 powers in the denominator. And that means that if I cut it off, it goes like log the cutoff. And now I can use my counter term and come in and cancel this off. So my six point vertex is now canceled off by the 6-point counter term, and things are still looking good in this case. Of course, I need some new measurement. Let's say I could look at 2-4 scattering of 5 particles, and I could connect that observable to this prediction and use it to fix the counter term and relate this to the physical 2-6 scattering cross section. But the thing that goes wrong here is that I can also have other kinds of divergences beyond what I had before. So the whole point with a normalizable theory was that I had a finite number of different kinds of divergences. And each kind of divergence, I can match up with the counter term and cancel it off. And that, in a sense, is the heart of normalizability. So as I was saying, that in a sense is the heart of a normalizability. And that's the thing we lose when we have these so-called higher dimensional operators, or so-called non-normalizable operators. They're called higher dimensional operators because they have, in terms of fields, dimension higher than 4. And that means that their prefactors, their effective couplings, have to have negative mass dimension. So an example of this here is, suppose I now go off and compute the 8-point function. So the 8-point function, again, it can have a contribution just from the normalizable side of things. But this is finite, as we saw before. Well, it's finite because we have 4 propagators. So everything that converges in the UV. But now there's a new contribution. From my new 6-point vertex. And the new, so this thing is finite. And this thing is going to have a log divergence. So I have 2 propagators. So that means I have 4 powers of the momentum in the denominator. And I integrate it d4q. So this thing is going to go is going to look like zeta over m squared squared times log of the cutoff. And the problem with this is if I fix my counter terms based on the 2-point, 4-point, and 6-point functions, I've now fixed them all. And I don't have enough counter term freedom to fix up this. So I have to go back to my Lagrangian. And if I wanted to make this finite, I have to go back and put in an 8-point counter term. And by the time I put in an 8-point counter term, I may as well also put in an 8-point operator in my original Lagrangian. And in a sense, because I've generated a new divergence, I need a new counter term. And by the time I need a new counter term, I may as well have the same coupling in my renormalized Lagrangian anyhow. And I could keep on going on. And it turns out that as soon as I add, for example, this 1 phi to the 6 operator, I need, it turns out, an infinite number of counter terms to get rid of all the infinite numbers of new divergences. And the thing that's going on in terms of dimensional analysis, you can see, is that because I now have an operator of negative mass dimension, I can, instead of saturating with positive mass dimensions, I now have this negative mass dimension thing appearing, and I can have, in a sense, powers of the cutoff over m squared correcting these various pieces. So the upshot is my theory is no longer renormalizable. I need an infinite number of counterterms. And in principle, I need an infinite number of experimental measurements to fix those infinite number of counterterms. And things look like a total mess. So instead of having a nice predictive theory where I need a finite number of inputs, I now have a theory where I seem to need an infinite number of inputs. And this was, this is more or less a view held on quantum field theories for quite a long time, that we should only look at renormalizable field theories. But somewhat more recently, and by somewhat more recently, I mean, let's say in the order past 40 or so years, the point of view has changed. Or at least, and people have started to feel more comfortable with non-renormalizable field theories. And the reason for this is that in whatever you're calculating, if you want to compare with experiment, there's always some uncertainty. And because there's always some uncertainty, it only makes sense to calculate to a certain finite accuracy. There's no sense in computing to an infinite accuracy. And even in this case, in quantum field theory, where we're doing these perturbative expansions, we don't even know how to compute to infinite accuracy, because we can only compute to such and such an order in the loop expansion. So it turns out that this finite accuracy story is what's going to help us make sense of non-renormalizable theories. So here's a non-renormalizable theory. In principle, I should add all the other possible operators to the theory that are consistent with the symmetries, because these will be eventually generated by loops, and I'll need counterterms for them. But the thing with these is these higher dimensional operators, these non-renormalizable operators, are, at least at low energies, in a sense, small. And what I mean by this is, suppose we look at 2 to 4 scattering. In 2 to 4 scattering, I mean phi phi goes to phi 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 phi. And there are various contributions to this. One contribution is obviously from the phi to the sixth operator. And the phi to the sixth operator would just give me the six-point vertex, and I'd have a contribution to the amplitude from that. But I also have a contribution to the amplitude. So here's my amplitude. And I'd also have a contribution to the amplitude, for example, from iterating the four-point function, from iterating the four-point vertex. And in principle, I can never have other contributions. But if I look at this and I apply dimensional analysis, the contribution to the cross-section, or let's say we just look at the amplitude, the contribution to the amplitude from this, if we look at very high momenta, if you look at relatively high momenta compared to the mass of the particle, I have one power of, let me write this as contributions to the cross-section. So the contribution to the cross-section from this diagram is going to be this squared. And then I have to go off and make this into something with mass dimension minus 2. And that means that with mass dimension minus 2, I'm going to need a p squared to get the dimensions right. If I go off and look at this thing, the contribution to the cross-section for this is I'm going to have a lambda cubed in the amplitude. So I'll have a lambda to the sixth. But there are no other dimensionful terms here. So I just have a 1 over p squared. So I can rewrite this first contribution as s squared p over m to the fourth, 1 over p squared. So I have these two different contributions to the cross-section. There will also be an interference term, but let's not worry about that for the time being. And the thing to compare is that here I have powers of p over m, and here I just have 1 over p squared. And if I look at this in the low energy limit, where p is much, much less than m, I get a really big suppression on this contribution. At least I get a really big suppression on this contribution relative to that one. So the point with these higher dimensional operators is that if I look at them at a sufficiently low energy, they become less and less important. And for example, if I was to go even higher, let's say the 8 point or above, those higher dimensional operators would have even more suppression from powers of P over M, because I'd have to have more powers of M squared in the denominator. So the moral of the story for these higher dimensional operators is that as they go from high energy to low energy, the operators that matter most go from being the very high dimension ones down to the lowest dimensional ones. And So this is essentially the moral of the story. As they go to low energies, the lowest dimensional operators end up mattering the most. And if I think about a non-renormalizable theory with an infinite number of operators, the ones that end up becoming most important at low energies are the ones that start to become the renormalizable ones. Now, if I start to measure at a really high accuracy, I might have to start including some finite number of non-renormalizable operators. But even though I now need, in principle, an infinite number of counterterms to deal with all the divergences, as a practical matter, the upshot of this is that if I'm computing to some finite accuracy, I only need to keep a finite number of the operators in this expansion. And that means that I can essentially neglect all the ones that are going to contribute smaller values compared to the ones I need to match my experimental accuracy. And because I now only need a finite number of operators, I only need a finite number of experimental inputs. And my theory is now predictive, in the sense that as long as I don't demand that the theory, as long as I stick to low energies, and as long as I content myself with some finite accuracy, I only need to keep a finite number of the operators. And because I only need to keep a finite number of the operators, and I can neglect the rest, I only need a finite number of experimental inputs. So I fix my finite number of experimental inputs, I go off and make predictions for all kinds of other stuff, and I get predictions. So the point with non-renormalizable theories is that they are predictive, provided you handle them properly. And by handling them properly, it means that you don't demand too much out of them, you don't demand too much accuracy in your predictions, and you stick to low energies. On the other hand, if I try to apply a theory that's non-renormalizable up to very high energies, I run into problems. And the problem with these is I don't have the suppression anymore, as p squared approaches m squared. And in principle, I need to keep an infinite number of operators, and I lose all predictivity. So what I want to motivate is that non-renormalizable operators are just fine. Non-renormalizable field theories are just fine, as long as you stick to low energy. OK, so that was one thing. I'm going to come back to non-renormalizable operators from a different point of view, from the point of view of effective field theories, in a second. But I want to make a brief interlude and talk about symmetries. OK, so we spoke about dimensional analysis. Dimensional analysis is, in a sense, trivial. It's also very useful. Essentially, it's making well-educated guesses before actually computing stuff. The other thing that you use a whole lot in quantum field theory that saves a lot of effort are symmetries. I just covered it up. But going back to my sort of canonical theory, this theory obviously has a symmetry. It obviously has a symmetry under phi to minus phi. Now, suppose we add a new term to this Lagrangian that breaks the symmetry. And the new term that breaks the symmetry is, suppose we take L and we add a cubic term. So this theory no longer has a phi to minus phi symmetry, but we would have a symmetry if A also transformed. So A doesn't actually transform. A is just some fixed coupling constant. But if we were to pretend that A also transforms along with phi, we would restore the symmetry. And even though the theory no longer has a symmetry under phi goes to minus phi, it does have a symmetry with this extra pretend bit. And this can be useful as well. And it can be useful as well in the sense that if we look at endpoint functions involving A or involving other stuff, they should still respect this, if you like, pretend symmetry. So what I mean by that is, suppose we look at a correction to the four-point function. So the four-point function is essentially an expectation value of four phi fields. So it should be even under the symmetry. And that means that if we were to look at the correction from A, well, we know there's a correction from lambda. It goes like lambda squared log lambda. But in principle, this can also have a correction from A. And to preserve the symmetry, this has to go like an even number of A factors. And you can see this just in practice. I can have a contribution to the four-point function. Okay, so actually this is a 1PI, but you get the idea. So for example, any contribution of the A operator to a four-point function has to have an even number of A powers. So this is sort of trivial, but it's consistent with a symmetry picture. This symmetry picture is more powerful though if we look at the three-point function. And the point of the three-point function, because it has three phi fields, has to be odd under this extended symmetry. And that means that this must necessarily be linear, or it should depend on an odd number of powers of A. So you can see this explicitly at one loop, but you can say, you know right off the bat, so you can show this explicitly. What's the contribution? There's a three-point function correction that goes like this. It's log divergent. And as you see, it has an odd number of powers of A, and it has a power of lambda. And in general, any correction to the three-point function has to be proportional to A. So in general, the three-point function has to be proportional to A. And for example, you might have worried that because the three-point function has mass dimension 1, maybe it could be linearly divergent. Maybe it could have a linear dependence on the cutoff. This is impossible precisely because the three-point function has to be proportional to A. And because it's proportional to A, you saturate the dimensional room for cutoff dependence. So the only divergence you can have is log. We can also look at the two-point function. And from the two-point function, we had the same corrections we had before. But we can now also have divergent corrections from the A piece. And it turns out that the leading A piece, the leading A correction, has the following form. And it corresponds to diagrams that look like this. This is obviously log divergent. And it's proportional to A squared. And it has to be proportional to A squared because of this residual pretend symmetry of the theory. So again, all I've done here is very trivial, But this technique of taking a theory that doesn't quite have a symmetry, but with a symmetry that can be restored by also transforming the coupling constants, this so-called Spurion technique, A is sometimes called a Spurion. Because the symmetry is said to be spurious. It's not a real symmetry, but it's a symmetry if you pretend that A transforms. This picture of spurious symmetries is very powerful as well. And one thing we get out of it is that any correction to the three-point function, anything that's going to come in with the A counter term, has to be proportional to A itself. And that means that, for example, one limit of the theory I could consider is I could make this A arbitrarily small. And from the point of view of this theory, if I make A arbitrarily small, because the corrections to A are always proportional to A, this is consistent with our ideas of naturalness. So I'll come back to this in a little bit. Let me give a second example. I'll just go through it quickly. And the second example is let's add a Dirac fermion to our theory. So L goes to L, where L is the same as before, plus a Dirac fermion, I gamma mu del mu, minus y by psi bar psi. And it turns out that this theory, so I'm assuming that this Lagrangian doesn't have the A piece. This theory has a symmetry under phi goes to minus phi, but also psi goes to minus I gamma phi psi, and psi bar goes to psi bar I gamma phi. And you can show that the transformation in this piece, the psi bar psi picks up a minus sign under this, exactly cancels this. So this theory has what's called a chiral symmetry. And we can break the symmetry if we add an explicit mass term for the fermion. So psi bar psi picks up a minus sign under the symmetry, but we could restore it if we make the symmetry spurious, and we also assume that m goes to minus m. So an immediate implication of this is that if I look at, because this is the only term in the theory that breaks the symmetry, this is the only piece that breaks the symmetry, or equivalently, I can restore the symmetry by making this coupling transform. As a result of this, any corrections to the mass of the fermion have to be proportional to the fermion mass itself. And you can see this explicitly at one loop, in that if I look at so instead of doing 2, 4, 6 or what have you, I'm now going to just show the operator I'm correcting. So this is the this is a psi bar psi vacuum expectation value, but one pi and connected. This thing has to go like m log lambda plus finite, and this thing has to be proportional to m because this combination is odd under our chiral symmetry. And to match that up with these transforming things, it has to go like this. And you can actually see this explicitly. So for example, in this theory, I've got my fermion. And there'd be a log divergent contribution from the phi loop. And this propagator is going to go like p slash plus m over p squared minus m squared. And it's the m piece that corrects the psi bar psi operator. So we see this explicitly, and it picks up two powers of, in this case, y squared. And in this theory, if I write down this combination, it turns out that I will also generate an effective cubic term. And what I mean by that is suppose I compute delta lambda 3, sorry, I'll write it as phi cubed. So far I've written down my Lagrangian without the a phi cube term, but it turns out that if I put in this symmetry breaking piece, I end up generating one, in the sense that there is a fermion loop of this form. And you can show that this piece goes like y cubed times m times log divergence. So in this theory, we started off without a phi cubed operator, but we find that we have to include a counter term for that operator because we generate a phi cubed divergence. And if you look at this phi cubed divergence, the effective value of the phi cubed divergence you generate has the right symmetry property, in the sense that this thing is odd under the set of transformations. And you see that it matches up with this thing being odd as well under that transformation. So by using this symmetry, in this case, it's not quite a symmetry. It's a symmetry that I sort of force upon it myself by pretending that the coupling transforms. By keeping track of how these couplings transform, these so-called spurion transformations, I can match up the fact that the effect of a term I generate has to be proportional to m. And you can also show that if I started off with an a phi cubed term here, there would be an a phi cubed correction to the fermion mass. Because again, that would also be consistent. Okay, so this is one example of symmetries. I want to move on, so I'm going to skip stuff. But have you seen the Goldstone mechanism, Goldstone bosons? So when you spontaneously break a symmetry, you get a massless pseudoscalar. Now, if you take that Goldstone picture, and suppose you didn't have an exact symmetry, suppose you had a symmetry that was approximate, but it is broken by some small symmetry breaking term. In that case, your Goldstone boson wouldn't actually be a Goldstone boson anymore. You don't have a symmetry anymore. But if the amount of symmetry breaking is small, you still get a very light scalar. And the mass of that scalar is proportional to the term of the Lagrangian that spontaneously breaks the symmetry. Sorry, that explicitly breaks the symmetry. So if you look at my notes, I have an explicit example of that. But I want to move on next to effective field theory, so I'm going to skip the example. But just keep in mind that between dimensional analysis and symmetries, you can go a long way without doing much hard calculation. Okay. So let's go back to the same theory I had before. But for the time being, let's ignore the symmetry breaking pieces. Okay, so this theory has a massless fermion and a massive scalar. And suppose we want to look at the theory in the limit of momenta, p squared, much, much less than m squared. So in this theory with p squared much, much less than m squared, we never actually have enough energy to produce phi particles, but we do have enough energy to produce the massless psi. So if we restrict ourselves to low energy, the only particles we're ever actually going to see explicitly, the only ones that we're going to produce in, let's say, our particle collider or what have you, or our experiment, are the massless phi particles. We never actually get the massive phis. And because of this, even though the phis mediate an interaction between the fermion psi, it would be nice to have a theory where we write down an effective Lagrangian that only involves the particles that we can actually observe in our experiment. This is what you do in practice. You do an experiment, you see some set of particles, and you write down a theory for those particles. And in general, if you don't see any other particles, you wouldn't be necessarily be inclined to put in those extra particles into your theory. So a natural thing to do, I claim, is if we're restricting ourselves to very low energies, is to write an effective theory that involves only the phi particles. So the leading terms in that effective theory, I know that my psi is massless, and I know that I'm going to have a phi mass term. So I know that at the very least, I have an L effective is equal to psi bar I gamma mu dou mu psi. But if this is the only thing I write down, my theory is not very interesting. I just have a massless phi particle zipping around and not interacting. But we know that because of the presence of the phi particles, the fermions psi are going to interact to some extent. And we can actually draw diagrams for the interaction. So the tree level diagrams for the interaction of, let's say, elastic psi psi goes to psi psi scattering are as follows. So I draw my Feynman diagrams for scattering from left to right. So 1 and 2 are the incoming states, 3 and 4 are the outgoing ones. And then I have this intermediate psi. And this diagram is going to be minus I y squared, because I have two vertices. And then I have one propagator. And the I is going to be t minus m squared, where t is p1 minus p3 squared. And I have a second diagram. Which is essentially the same as the first, but now my phi leg connects to 2, my 4 leg connects to 1. And this thing is just going to be minus iy squared times I over u minus m squared, where u is p1 minus p4. So we know that in this theory, there is non-trivial psi scattering. But the non-trivial psi scattering depends on the scalar phi to mediate it. Now, we want to capture this effect writing only psi fields. And one way to capture this, let's say we focus on this piece. Okay, in principle, I could have also written the fermion stuff. So I would have had a u bar 3, u 1, u bar 4, u 2, external spinners. And then here I would have a u bar 4, u 1, u bar 3, u 2. Again, just the usual fermion structures. I can take this piece, and at low momentum, p squared much, much less than m squared, the t is going to be much smaller than m squared. So I can rewrite this thing as a 1 over m squared. I'll write it as a minus 1 over m squared, 1 plus t over m squared plus t squared over m to the fourth, dot, 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 dot. So in principle, I have an infinite, let me pull this up a bit. In principle, I have an infinite number of terms. But we see that if we concentrate on p squared much, much less than m squared, this is the most important one. And this is the next most important, yada, yada, yada. So if we focus on this piece has a form of 4 fermion legs and a propagator that is essentially trivial times a minus 1 over m squared. And it turns out that this effect, if I only keep the leading term, can be um, can be described by the following effective operator. So I won't work it out, but it's not hard to see that if I take this interaction and I compute the process psi psi goes to psi psi, I reproduce these amplitudes where I only keep this leading term in the expansion. So in other words, this is the result for my full theory. And I've just written down an effective theory that captures the leading term in the expansion of these propagators. And in principle, I could also write more terms if I wanted to start capturing higher orders in these momentum pieces. So to capture the higher orders, I'd have to have stuff with derivatives acting on some of the psi fields. So for example, with derivatives acting on some of the psi fields, when I put it into my momentum space Feynman rules, the derivatives would bring down momentum factors that would make up things like t and t squared and so on. But the upshot of that is those terms with more derivatives would have to have more powers of m squared in the denominator. So this is the leading interaction. And if I focus on very low energies and I don't measure things too carefully, this is all I need to keep in my effective theory to get a good description of the data. So what I've just done is I started with a renormalizable theory, and I've rewritten it as I focused on the low energy limit, and I've rewritten it as an effective theory that only involves the light particles that I can produce directly. And the effective theory I get, even though the initial theory was renormalizable, the resulting effective theory is non-renormalizable, and that this is a coupling of negative mass dimension. And in principle, I can also get higher orders with even higher mass dimensions. But if I stick to low energies, this is the only operator I need to keep. And it turns out that for sufficiently low energies, this gives me a good description of the data. So this is the idea of effective field theories. You start, or in principle, you start from some larger high energy theory. There may or may not be renormalizable. And starting from this high energy theory that you assume to have some heavy states in it, you write down effective theory that only involves the light states. It only involves the light states you can see at low energies. And from this, you get an effective field theory that's typically non-renormalizable, but where the mass scale of the non-renormalizable terms is related to the mass of the thing you've gotten rid of. So getting rid of heavy stuff, the technical term for that is integrating it out. So here, you can say that I've integrated out the scalar to give this effective field theory, with this being the leading term in it. And again, you have higher terms, but those are subleading at low energies. So from this point of view, seeing, maybe I've just, still have it up here. So from this point of view, seeing non-renormalizable terms in your Lagrangian isn't so bad. In that, if I only write down a theory involving the light fields, the ones I can observe in my experiment, I don't tend to put in heavy stuff that I can't see. And the easiest way to describe the interactions between the light things often involve these non-renormalizable operators. So if I'm stuck at energies much lower than the heavy things, the first thing I'm inclined to do in my theory is to write down non-renormalizable terms. And from that point of view, from the bottom-up perspective, these non-renormalizable operators can be interpreted as signals of some new heavy states that I just haven't included in the theory yet. And here, you see that you see that this expansion only makes sense for momentum much, much smaller than this m squared, the mass scale that's suppressing the higher dimensional operators. And this is exactly what we found when we spoke about non-renormalizable theories. In the non-renormalizable theories, we were only able to use them predictively at low energies. As we went to high energies, we had to keep an infinite number of terms. That was no good. We see that in our effective field theory, as you start going to high energies approaching m squared, we also need to keep an infinite number of terms to reproduce the dynamics of the phi particle. And the thing that's going wrong, the reason why we need these infinite number of terms, is just that we're not describing the phi dynamics properly in the limit where we start to produce the phi particle directly. So this is a bottom-up point of view. The non-normalizable terms, we usually interpret them as some signal of some new heavy state that we haven't yet discovered. But in this specific example, we also had the luxury of starting from a normalizable high energy theory. So in this case, we knew the high energy theory, and we went down, and we matched the low energy theory to the high energy theory by writing operators in the low energy theory such that I reproduce the predictions of the high energy theory. We also had the luxury in this case of, by implicit assumption, this theory we assumed was weakly coupled, and that we assumed that we could do perturbation theory in Y, and everything goes well. There are cases where you know the high energy theory, but as you go to low energies, it becomes strongly coupled, and you have to work much harder to find the low energy theory valid below that strong coupling scale. So one example is QCD. I guess you saw aspects of QCD in your standard model course. And what happens there is at high energies, you have a theory of quarks and gluons. But because of asymptotic freedom, meaning that the coupling gets small at high energies, this also implies that your coupling gets large at low energies. And as you run this coupling down in energy, it turns out that at energies near a GeV, this coupling becomes really strong. And instead of having quarks and gluons, it binds them all into color-neutral bound states. And it turns out that in this case, you can write down an effective theory involving pions and possibly baryons. So did you look at this kind of thing? Write down a pion theory? Not really? OK, so I'll come to it later in this course when I talk about BSM theories of strong coupling. But so I just wanted to mention in passing that sometimes, even if you know the high energy theory, it's non-trivial to find the low energy theory if it's strongly coupled. Now, if we go and think about the standard model, the standard model, Lagrangian, as it's usually written, is completely renormalizable. So this is both good in that the renormalizable theory, it's very predictive. We only need a finite number of counter terms and a finite number of measurements to test it. On the other hand, though, the fact that it's renormalizable also is unfortunate in that we don't have any hints for where new physics has to come in. That's only partially true. We do have evidence for new physics in the form of neutrino masses. So in the standard model alone, it's not possible to write, or in the renormalizable standard model alone, it's not possible to write down neutrino masses. But I guess you cover this in the tutorial today. Suppose I add to the standard model Lagrangian the following term. An LH squared operator. So this is the Higgs doublet, and this is the Lepton doublet. This thing is gauge invariant, and it has one power here. I have to type on my notes. So this is gauge invariant. I have one power of this. So this is dimension 5, so I need one power here. And it turns out that this is going to generate neutrino masses, and you'll talk about it a little bit in class. Another possible gauge invariant operator you can write down in the standard model is this. Again, this is a higher dimensional operator that's gauge invariant. So it's consistent with all the standard model symmetries, at least all the gauge symmetries. But you can show that this thing has a net violates baryon plus lepton number. And because of this, it turns out this operator can mediate proton decay. And we tried very hard to find proton decay, and we haven't seen anything yet, which means that we can put very strong limits on this M scale here. In the same way that the measure of neutrino masses suggests that this M scale here is something like 10 to the 12 GeV. So before I pack up, let me just say one last thing about naturalness. So we've talked about the hierarchy problem on Tuesday. And since then, we've talked a lot about renormalization and effective field theories. There's one more piece, and that is connecting the hierarchy problem to effective field theories. OK, So let's go back to, where are we? Let's go back to this theory, but let's now add the fermion mass term, M psi bar psi. In this case, we can go off and go back and compute the two-point function for the scalar. Sorry. And you can show that this thing has the following form. So there's a correction to the effective mass of phi squared from the mass of fermion. And again, this has an odd number, even number of powers of m squared, so it's consistent with our extended symmetry. And now suppose we were to look at the theory in the limit of m much, much bigger than m. So in other words, suppose we try to make the fermion much heavier than the scalar. In this case, we would be inclined to write down an effective theory involving only the scalar field. So we want to integrate out the fermion from the theory. What we did above here is we integrated out the scalar only at tree level. In principle, you can also compute loop corrections in the full theory and match them to effective operators in the effective theory. And we can do the same thing here. So suppose we want to integrate out the fermion from the theory. It turns out that beyond just the divergent contributions from this, and beyond the divergent contributions, there's also a finite correction to the effective mass of the phi particle of this form. And this brings us back to our naturalness issue, in that if we try to take the limit of m much, much bigger than m, when we integrate out the heavy fermion, we get this really big correction to the scalar mass that wants to pull the scalar mass up to close to the fermion mass. So from this effective field theory point of view, because we get this large so-called threshold correction from integrating out the heavy fermion, we see that in these theories with scalars and fermions interacting, the scalar mass doesn't like to be all that much smaller than the fermion mass. And for example, if we apply this to the standard model and we assume that with our Higgs, suppose there's some new fermion that's very, very heavy, it couples to the Higgs, when we integrate that out, we would expect, again, a finite correction of the Higgs mass parameter of exactly this form. And this is just another recasting of the hierarchy problem, that scalar masses are specifically sensitive to integrating out heavy new physics. And beyond the divergent pieces, there are these finite corrections. So we can always get rid of the divergent pieces with counterterms. We're still stuck with these finite pieces, though, that in principle you could put into the counterterms, but we're still stuck with these finite pieces that suggest that scalar masses don't like to be all that much less than the masses of other things in the theory. So this is another restatement of the hierarchy problem. Now, I could also look at the same thing for corrections to the fermion mass. And a correction to the fermion mass would correspond to some part of a correction to the psi bar psi operator. And a correction to the psi bar psi operator, the corresponding diagram for that would have this form. And we just saw that before. So this kind of correction, suppose I look at instead in the limit of m squared much, much less than m squared. And now I'm writing down an effective theory for psi, where I integrate out the heavy scalar, similar to what I do here. But now I include the loop correction to the fermion mass. This loop correction to the fermion mass goes like divergent plus, here I get 2 powers of y squared, 4 pi squared. It turns out you get a log divergence, but the whole thing ends up being proportional to the fermion mass. And the proportionality to the fermion mass can be understood from our spurious symmetry picture that I think I've covered up. We know that this operator is odd under that sign change thing, and that means that it has to be proportional to at least 1 power of m. At that 1 power of m, essentially saturates the dimensionality and means that, for example, I couldn't have powers of the cutoff, or I couldn't have powers of m in here as well. So the upshot of this is that fermion masses are, in a sense, protected from large quantum corrections, in that the correction of the fermion mass is some loop factor that we assume is relatively small times the fermion mass itself, whereas scalar masses are very sensitive to new corrections. And the scalar masses are sensitive to new corrections because in this limit, this thing ends up being very big, whereas in this limit, no matter how heavy I make the scalar, this correction is still under control. So the last thing I wanted to mention, I'll wrap up there, is that scalar masses are, in a sense, uniquely sensitive to heavy new physics. Things like fermion masses don't have that sensitivity because there are these chiral symmetries that can protect them. And it turns out that a similar protection applies to vector bosons. So for example, there's no related hierarchy problem for the W or Z bosons or the photon. And there's no hierarchy problem for the fermions of the standard model. But there is a hierarchy problem specifically for the fundamental scalar of the standard model, which is the Higgs. So a big motivator for new physics is this hierarchy problem, and is trying to find ways to address the seemingly very small mass parameter for what we think is a fundamental scalar Higgs particle. And one thing that just to add to that before I finish, the Higgs, if it really is a fundamental scalar, will be the first and only fundamental scalar we've ever found. So all the other scalar particles we've seen have turned out to be composites, for example. So you can see net scalar nuclei that are made up of fermionic protons and neutrons. You see scalar pions and other mesons that turn out to be composites of quarks and gluons. As far as we know, the Higgs is the only fundamental scalar, and it's the fact that it's a fundamental scalar and it has this very strong sensitivity to higher scales that gives rise to the hierarchy problem and motivates a lot of BSM physics. So I better wrap up.